Thank you very much for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here as usual. And so let me do the Blackboard talk. So I was told that at least half of people here are not particle physicists. So I'll try to be very basic and just explain things rather slowly from the very beginning. Why what we're doing is important, and what is that we are trying to do with the Large Hadron Collider, and how we do it. And in case my particle physicist friends here have more detailed questions, I would be happy to sort of interact in a more detailed way. The talk which I prepared, in fact, has just a number of vignettes, and we could go into more detail on any of them. So what I think I'll do, I'll just briefly tell you what we are trying to do, how we do it, how the LHC, Large Hadron Collider, operates, why it's important to have the energy at which we are now, how the detector operates, sort of a 5-minute sketch on how we detect different final states, and then I'll use a couple examples which are probably one of the most interesting to this crowd, searches for supersymmetry and searches for the Higgs bosons, which are one of the major parts of the LHC physics program and CMS physics program. And I'll use CMS sometimes as an example, which is a little bit closer to me, since I know the detector a little better than I know the Atlas detector. But in general, both these experiments are very complementary, and what I'm going to say applies to essentially all the physics problems of these big experiments. So essentially, what I'll try to do is to answer three questions: why, where, and how. And these are the questions which we as humankind always ponder. We always want to know why we are here, where we came from, and how the universe will evolve after our presence here. And essentially, these are the fundamental questions. And what I'll try to answer is a subset of these questions, namely why we are doing this physics at Large Hadron Colliders, what's so important about these energies which we are going to explore, where this Hadron Collider is and how it operates, and how exactly we are looking for things experimentally at this machine. So let me just start by reminding you that the last decade, the last 15 years, presumably, showed a lot of connections, interconnections between particle physics and cosmology. In fact, what we learned is that the physics of the largest scales, such as clusters of galaxies, are very well maybe defined by the physics at the shortest scales, such as quantum fluctuations of the vacuum. And therefore, by studying things at very short distances, we not only probing inside the fundamental particles, whether they are indeed fundamental, if there's some substructure for these particles, such as quarks or leptons, but we may be also answering problems which are important for cosmology. And there is a much more connection between particle physics and cosmology than just this example suggests. Recently, we learned that a lot about the black hole thermodynamics could be explained by particle physics or quantum field theory methods, and so forth. And even experimentally, there's a lot of synergy these days. A, we both have large calibrations and very complex scientific instruments. That's the way the science is evolving. We really have to do big science, which costs a lot, and that means that a lot of people are working together building these apparatus, whether it's Hubble Space Telescope or CMS or Atlas detector. And we both essentially, the principle of our operations is based on Heisenberg uncertainty principle, which is delta P times delta X is of the order of H bar. And in what follows, I will use the Planck units, which we always use in particle physics, meaning that H bar equals to C equals to 1, which essentially means that I only have two units which I'm going to use for explaining everything in this talk. One is the unit of energy, which is the same in these units as the unit of mass, which is the same as the unit of momentum. And I'll use the energy of a proton at rest, which is roughly 1 GeV, 1 GeV electron volt, 10 to the 9 electron volt. Basically, if you put 10 million car batteries together and try to accelerate electron across, you would get this energy. probably average of what you could get from stretching all the California car together, connecting them, and trying to push the electrons through the cold chain. The other variables we shall use are time and distance, and they have units of inverse GeV in this Planck system of units. And inverse GeV is roughly 2×10⁻¹⁹ meters, which is roughly 0.2 microfermi. So these are units which I'm going to use. And in these units, since delta P and delta E are basically the same for ultra-existing particles, this becomes delta E times delta X is of the order of 1, which means that if I want to probe short distances, I have to go to large energy changes, energy transfers. So delta X is of the order of 1 over delta E, and since the maximum change in energy you could have is the energy of the initial particle, if you just stop it completely to probe the matter, this is, for us, is of the order of 1 over E. So essentially, in order to go to the distances of the order of 10⁻¹⁹ meters, we need energies of GeV and so forth, and that's how we're going to operate the Hadron Collider. That's why we need large energy to probe different space. If you think about these, cosmologists and astrophysicists are also driven by the same Heisenberg uncertainty principle, because diffraction limit of the telescope, delta theta, is of the order of lambda divided by the size of the mirror, and that's essentially the same Heisenberg uncertainty principle, just expressed in optical, from the optical point of view, rather than the energy and momentum point of view.
Okay. I think your 10⁻¹⁹ meters is a TeV inverse.
Right, that's 10⁻¹⁹ meters, you're right.
So one should be 0.2 Fermi generally.
20 microfermi per GeV, so for 10⁻¹⁹ you need TeV. Sorry, I woke up around midnight your time to make my flight, so. Of between GeV and TeV. So the two machines which are currently in operation, the highest energy machines which we use, are the so-called Tevatron, which operates in Batavia near Chicago, Illinois. As the name suggests, the energy of the Tevatron is of the order of 1 TeV. In fact, it collides two beams of proton and antiproton just shy of 1 TeV. So the total energy, which we conveniently denote as square root of S, where S is the Mandelbrot variable, is 1.96 TeV. And the other machine, which is main subject of my talk, is the LHC Large Hadron Collider. So this is P bar P system. And the LHC collides two beams of protons head-on, and each beam of proton currently has the energy of 3.5 TeV. So the total energy of the machine is 7 TeV. And in a few years, as I'll explain, it would go to the design value of 14 TeV, which is another factor of 2. But what's important is that we're really crossing new threshold by switching from the Tevatron to the LHC. We increase the energy by half an order of magnitude, and we hope that some things could just open up which were inaccessible by the Tevatron before. And let's talk a bit about some of these things. So all of you, of course, know very well about the standard model, which is a very successful model built in the 60s by Glashow, Salam, Weinberg, Hooft, and other people who contributed to understanding of this model. And this is one of the most beautiful models in physics developed so far. It's very economic. It essentially describes the entire set of the interactions of the particles using just three parameters, which have been measured with very high precision. And that allows us to predict a lot of different phenomena. We could calculate things to the precision of the order of 1 per mil, and sometimes even much higher precision than 1 per mil. But essentially, we tested the standard model since the 60s, over the last 50 years or so, 40 years or so, to the precision well beyond 1 per mil. And we haven't seen any single significant deviation from the standard model, which tells us that this seemed to be correct. correct description of the universe, except that this is very puzzling because from the mathematics of the standard model, it seems that big chunks are missing. Also, some observational things which we see cannot be really explained in the standard model, at least in a natural way. And there actually, apart from this, even the mathematics of the standard model itself has some peculiarities which I'm going to talk about, which are known as the hierarchy problem. And the beauty of the standard model is that not only it explains essentially all known fermion, the quark, up, charm, top, and down, strange, and bottom, and the corresponding neutrinos, three flavors of neutrinos and three flavors of leptons, P, mu, and tau, but it explains the gauge interaction and the interaction of the quarks by various gauge forces, which are the strong force carried by a gluon, electric force carried by W particles which are charged, Z particle, and a photon. And what it doesn't really explain is the gravitational interaction, which presumably is carried by the graviton, which is spin 2 particle. However, these particles are all spin 1 particles, S equals 1. This is S equals 2, which hasn't been confirmed experimentally yet. But one important thing which is still missing from the standard model is the thing which explains the masses of the fundamental fermions. And moreover, we need this extra mechanism to explain the fact why electromagnetic interaction is so different from weak interaction at low energy. And this is completely driven by the fact that photon, which is carrier of electromagnetic interaction, is massless, so the interaction is long range, whereas the W and Z particles have the mass of the order of 100 GeV, 100 times the mass of the proton, which tells us that the range of this interaction, just by the same Heisenberg uncertainty principle, is extremely short. However, fundamentally, the standard model shows that the interaction of WZ and photon are very similar. In fact, both Z and photon are just a mixture of two fields, which are the basis of the electroweak unification theory, and we need special mechanism to explain why photon remains massless, whereas Z requires certain mass, and this is known as Higgs mechanism, which was proposed again in the 60s by Higgs and five other scientists, Brut and Englert, Buraunik, Hagen, and Hibble, who received the Sakurai Prize last year, actually, for discovery of this mechanism. And the necessary component of this mechanism is so-called Higgs boson, which is the particle with spin equals zero, with the mass, which is, the value of the mass is really a billion-dollar question, that's why we build this machine, but we expect the mass of the Higgs boson to be also the order of 100 GeV, and that explains why, essentially, all the machines which have energy above 100 GeV, such as Tevatron, previous machine which was run at CERN, which is lepton collider, plus minus collider left, and of course LHC, are all hunting for this particle, which so far we haven't seen. One interesting thing about, or maybe interesting thing about the Higgs mechanism, Higgs particle, that not only it explains the masses of the fundamental bosons which carry gauge interaction between the quarks and leptons, but it also explains, or can explain, rather, the mass of the quarks and perhaps even the mass of the leptons wire couplings to the Higgs field. And essentially, the mass term, mass of the fermion, is given by the coupling of this fermion to the Higgs field divided by some normalization constant square root of 2 times the fundamental parameter, which is called vacuum expectation value of the Higgs field. This is the value at which electric symmetry is broken, and this value is completely determined by the mass of, say, Z boson and the mixing angle of these two fields, which create gamma, which create massless photon and massless Z. So that has been measured quite precisely, and it's equal to 246 GeV. And one thing which you immediately see from this formula is that if I plug in the top quark mass here, essentially I get lambda T equals to 101 plus minus 0.01. So within 1% experimental precision, the coupling of the top quark to the Higgs is equal to 1. This is not a very precise statement because couplings, of course, run with the energy, but they run logarithmically. So in large range of energies, the value of this coupling is very close to 1. One could ponder on this, whether it's a pure numerical coincidence, whether there is some fundamental reason why this coupling is very close to 1. But what's really puzzling is that if you take the other cousin of top quark, say up quark or down quark, its mass is only about 5 MeV versus 170 GeV here. So there's 30,000 difference, factor of 30,000 difference between the mass of the U quark and the mass of the top quark. So if lambda T is of the order of 1, lambda U is of the order of 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 5. And explaining why the couplings of different particles to the Higgs boson are so different, and different by many orders of magnitude, is quite challenging. And standard model, in fact, does not provide any explanation for this. Internally, just postulates that apart from the three very economic parameters which I need to explain the interactions, I need to add another number of parameters equal to the masses of the fermions, which I could relate to their coupling to the Higgs, but I cannot really explain why their numbers are such. But perhaps the fact that the coupling to the top quark is equal to 1 might be telling us something very special about the top quark, or maybe top and bottom quark, which is part of the third generation. That's why a lot of interest at the LHC and previously at the Tevatron was devoted to the study of the third generation of matter, which might have some special properties in terms of couplings to the Higgs. So that brings me directly to the hierarchy problem, which can be expressed in several at several different levels. The easiest level to express it is just to compare the Coulomb force with Newton force, essentially comparing electromagnetism with gravity, and of course the force for gravitational interaction is given by the G Newton times the product of the two interacting body masses divided by the distance between these two bodies squared. And I could write very similar expression for electromagnetic interaction where I replace Newton coupling constant with what I will call Coulomb constant, coupling constant, depending which units you prefer, if you use 1/4 pi x or not, so forth. And then I replace masses with charges, and it's basically a very similar formula, which tells me that I could come up with a system of units in which I measure mass and charge in the same units, just like in my Planck units, energy and mass are measured in the same units. And if I do so, I could express G Newton and G Coulomb in this set of units. And when I do this, I find out that one differs from the other by 10 to the 38, so 38 orders of magnitude. And that is known as the hierarchy problem. For some reason, the gravitational force is some 38 orders of magnitude, should probably do 38 here, is less than the Coulomb electromagnetic force. And this is very hard to explain from the point of view of pure mass, because I need to find something which gives me 10 to the 38 suppression or 10 to the 38 enhancement. Even this looks puzzling, but that's only 5 order of magnitude difference, but the difference between gravity and electromagnetism is many, many orders of magnitude worse. And this is known as hierarchy problem, which you can also express in pure quantum field theory term as the fine-tuning problem. And namely, since we know about the existence of the Higgs boson in the standard model, which otherwise works very precisely, so there is no particular reason not to believe that such a mechanism might be correct, you could look at the quantum corrections to the Higgs mass via quantum loops. And of course, since Higgs couplings are proportional to the masses, Higgs likes to couple to the heaviest particles which are in the standard model. And the heaviest particles are top quarks, to a certain extent bottom quarks, and also W and G bosons. So this is 170 GeV, this is 80 and 90 GeV. So that means that the Higgs mass will have contributions from the loop where you have TT bar pair, or the loop where you have W pair, or Z pair, running around. And it turns out that if you calculate this loop, you cannot really calculate them without introducing the cutoff, integration cutoff. And when you do this, introducing the cutoff lambda, it turns out that the amplitude for this loop is proportional to the lambda squared. So essentially, everything runs away if you go to higher and higher energies. So if you want your standard model to work to the highest energies there are, which presumably are the energy at which the gravitational interactions is comparable in strength with the electromagnetic interaction, which is known as Planck energy or Planck mass of the order of 10 to 19 GeV. If I want to standard model to be correct to that level, I would have somehow to cancel the divergences coming from the loops. And what helps me here is the fact that the sign of this diagram for the fermion is opposite to the sign of the diagram where I exchange the bosons. So I should put the minus sign between these two diagrams. And if I do so, I could in principle adjust all the masses of the fermions and all the masses of the W and Z bosons. And if I do so in order to make the Higgs mass to be finite of the order of 100 GeV, in order for this mass not to run away quadratically, I have to fine-tune all the masses of the particles running in the loop to the precision of the order of 10 to the minus 19 or 10 to the minus 16, because the precision would be given by mass of the Higgs divided by this maximum scale squared. So if I take mass of the Higgs of 10 or 100 GeV, 10 to the 2 GeV, and Planck scale 10 to the 19th GeV, I have 10 to the minus 17 squared or 10 to the minus 34 amount of fine tuning I need to do in order to keep the Higgs mass finite, which what we would like to do in the standard model. This sounds like a big stretch. 10 to the minus 34 fine tuning is fairly hard to achieve theoretically, as I'm sure you know. However, I could give you some examples of fine tuning which exist in nature so that you could just ponder on that. And sometimes, if you have something which is fine tuned to a very high precision or something very close to zero, perhaps there is some fundamental principle which governs this fine tuning. It might be not coincidental. So, this small number might tell us something very peculiar. So let me give you some examples and you will figure out which ones are true fine-tuned examples and which ones are not so fine-tuned. Probably the best known example of fine-tuning in the nature is the eclipse of the moon, of the sun with the moon. So it turns out that the angular size of the moon, if observed from Earth, is the same as the angular size of the sun to the precision of 2.5%. This is purely accidental. There was no particular reason why the moon has certain diameter and its distance to the Earth is essentially the same as the ratio of the diameter of the sun to the distance from the Earth to the sun. This just happened, and this example of fine-tuning in nature tells us that something of the order of 1% happens once in a while, and because of this, we actually could witness such a beautiful natural phenomena as the eclipse of the sun. So this is a pure fine-tuning example. So perhaps something which is fine-tuned to 1% shouldn't particularly puzzle us. The other example which is less known is the infamous Florida elections, where the number of Republican votes to the Democratic votes was fine-tuned as 2913321 over 2913144. And that caused Al Gore his defeat in this particular event. And if you think about what this ratio is, this is fine-tuned to the 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 5 precision. As far as I know, there's absolutely no fundamental principle which governs this fine-tuning. On the other hand, this is not a very fair example of fine-tuning, because this is just one election out of many, and one state out of many. And only in this particular occasion, the fine-tuning happened to this particular degree. So if I want to play fair, I probably should take into account all other outcomes, over the history of United States election. And then you will see that this fine-tuning of 10 to the minus 4, which looks very funny, if you start just thinking about this one event, becomes not so irregular, because you certainly had about 1,000 different trials, and only one of these trials gave you this amount of fine-tuning. So certain things might be fine-tuned, might appear fine-tuned, and fundamentally they're not. Now, another example which is least known probably to this audience, I didn't know it until I was flying on one of the airplanes, and you know, you always have this dilemma when you open up your laptop Friday night, there's somebody sitting next to you, and if you start working on something related to what you're doing, usually this dreadful question, what are you doing, comes at some point, and there are many answers to this question. I haven't found the clear winner one. You never know which way the conversation might go, but at this point the guy says, oh, you're a physicist, that's very interesting. Do you know why 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 divided by 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, do you know what it is? I said, well, I cannot tell you exactly, it's close to 8, but you know, I can tell you in a moment. So I pulled out my calculator, and sure enough, the answer is 8,000,000,000,000,073. Go figure. Well, I told him, well, let me think about this, but it's not coincidental. And if you think about this, it is not coincidental. But the fact that it's so fine-tuned to something integer might tell you something. In this case, you could figure out the answer. I'll give you a hint. Try your hexadecimal calculator and increase the number of digits here using hexadecimal system, and you'll find the answer for yourself. So basically, the message which I want to carry is that things could be just fine-tuned. Things could be fine-tuned because we are looking at one instance out of many possibilities, and things could be fine-tuned because there's some fundamental principle which is not obvious at the first glance, but which you might find if you think about the problem. And the hope is that the 10 to the minus 34 fine-tuning is the fine-tuning of the third kind, namely there is some fundamental principle which explains it, and our goal is to find what this principle might be. So let me tell you about a few possible explanation for this, possible solution to this. Before doing this, I just want to tell about other problems of the standard model, which may be not so mathematical as this fine-tuning problem, but they're also quite overwhelming and quite important to solve. One problem comes again from the cosmology, and by now it's very well established that cosmic pi has about 5% of the baryonic matter, that's the standard model particles and fields. About 22% is something which we call dark, matter, which is not part of the standard model, that much we know, at least most of it not part of the standard model. And the rest, 73%, is something we have even less clue about, and we call it dark energy. And I might talk a little bit about the possibility of looking at dark energy at the LHC, but I would mainly talk about dark matter. And whenever you hear some nice, sophisticated talk from a cosmologist with many transparencies, tells you that they know everything about the universe, remember this guy only knows about 5% of the universe. They're trying to find another 20%, so it might be a little bit more interesting on this point of view. So dark matter, there's no good candidate in the particles which I included in the standard model which I have here. Neither neutrinos could be dark matter, nor Higgs or photons could be dark matter, and we need to find something else. The other problem, which also is related to the cosmology, is matter-antimatter symmetry, because presumably during the Big Bang, particles were produced in pairs. However, the universe, observable universe, mainly consists of matter. If there is antimatter in the universe, it's extremely small. So that means that for every large number of particles, like 10 to the 90 particles which we produced, there was an excess somehow of one particle over the antiparticle, and they didn't annihilate completely. And what remains is actually what makes us possible to survive, to exist, and to think about these questions. And this the fact that some of the particles presumably change into antiparticles of some kind during the evolution of the universe tells you that one possibility is that there is a deep connection between the three generation of quarks and three generation of leptons, namely quarks which interact by strong interaction and leptons which interact via weak interactions might have some common interaction at larger energies, which were the energies which happened during the Big Bang. Then this interaction essentially was responsible for changing some of the particles in the antiparticles, might explain the asymmetry of matter in the universe. If we have this force, which may happen at very high energy, we could ask ourselves the question, how the forces look like as a function of energy. Do forces stay separate, or somehow these forces become unified? One example of unified force is the example of electroweak interaction, which took us some time to understand that electroweak interaction is, in fact, electromagnetism and weak interactions are not separate forces. They are really two faces of one force, and the difference in scale of these forces merely has to do with the fact that photon is massless and the W and Z have mass. On the other hand, the fundamental coupling of the W's and Z's to fermions is about the same as the coupling of photons to electric charge. So in fact, these are two faces of one force. Earlier than that, we know another example of unification. That was unification done by Faraday and Maxwell, unification of electrostatic and magnetic and magnetism, electricity and magnetism, where we figure out that electricity and magnetism are just two faces of one and the same electromagnetic force, which is captured very well in Maxwell's equations. And perhaps even early on, the first example of unification was the idea of Newton that the seemingly very different force, the force which keeps moon going around the Earth, is the same force as keeps the apple falling down from the apple tree. So the history of science shows that things seem to be unifying, and maybe it makes sense to think about unification of strong interaction and electroweak interaction. And in the last century, we learned a lot about the way the gauge forces behave with energy, namely forces run with energy. The coupling constants are not constant. They are function of energy. They change rather slowly. They change logarithmically. But if you look at the standard model and look at the couplings, such as strong coupling, electromagnetic coupling, and weak coupling, you would find out that these three couplings tend to intersect at some energy which is a little bit below the Planck energy, something like 10 to the 16 GeV. If you measure things very precisely here, and you know the evolution of the coupling with energy from the quantum field theory, you would find out that the three couplings, although they tend to unify in the same place, they basically miss each other a little bit in the standard model. However, if you start adding extra particles in the standard model, you could cure this, and the model which I'm going to talk about next, the supersymmetric model, has somewhat different behavior of the couplings. And in this model, all three of them actually unify almost precisely with experimental precision at the value of the order of 10 to the 16 GeV, so a little bit off here. And that might be suggestive that strong force and electromagnetic force are two faces of some bigger grand unified forces, and that's why quarks and leptons are not independent of each other. They talk to each other, which might explain something about the matter and antimatter asymmetry in the universe. So it would make sense for us to try to look for these connections between quarks and leptons at the LHC as well. So some theoretical solutions to this problem, hierarchy problem, and some other problems of the standard model, such as non-existence of dark matter in the standard model, have been addressed theoretically for many years now. And one of the most popular models which addresses many of these questions, namely grand unification, the existence of dark matter, and lack of fine-tuning, is the supersymmetry, which also has direct connections to string theory, and in fact, string theory requires supersymmetry, maybe at higher scale than what we want to find at the LHC, but it should be there for the string theory to be self-consistent. And supersymmetry is a really beautiful idea, but it's not very economical, unlike the standard model. So in the supersymmetry, for every particle of the standard model, say if I take a U-quark, there is another particle, supersymmetric partner, which we call in this case quark, supersymmetric quark. And this is U-quark, this is U-squark. And the quarks as fermions of the standard model have spin equals 1/2. Quarks are scalar particles. They have spin equals 0. By the same token, for every gauge boson which exists in the standard model, there is a particle which is a fermion in supersymmetry. For example, if I take a photon, there is a particle which I could call Fontino. Photon has spin equals 1. Fontina has spin equals 1/2. Higgs would have a Higgsino. Higgs has spin 0. Higgsino also has spin 1/2. In reality, things are a little bit more complex because it turns out that Fontina and Higgsino mix together. But in general, every particle in the standard model would have a super partner, which differs by spin 1/2. And you would ask yourself, why on earth do I need such a complicated symmetry? Why do I need to double the number of particles? And the reason is very simple. The reason is this minus sign here, because now I could cancel the loop with the top quark. Instead of putting W and Z and fine-tuning things, I would put top quark in the loop. And since top quark is a boson and not a fermion, these two loops cancel each other almost precisely if the mass of the stop quark and top quark are about the same. So that was the original idea of supersymmetry. It naturally cancels all these divergences and you get finite mass of the Higgs. The only problem is that we know that there are no, say, super partner of an electron, which would be a selectron, with the mass of the order of 512 keV. We searched for these particles and we haven't found it. Then we know that if selectrons exist, their mass is at least 100 GeV or so. And this also applies to all other supersymmetric particles. We know that if they exist, the supersymmetry is somehow broken, and masses cannot be exactly the same. Fontina is certainly not massless. We haven't seen massless Fontina, and so forth. So, however, if I want to solve the hierarchy problem, I cannot make these super partners too heavy, because if I make them too heavy, the cancellation won't be precise, and I would run again in the fine-tuning problem. So if I want my theory to be fine-tuned to of the order of 1%, not more than 1%, essentially the masses of these supersymmetric particles have to be less than roughly 1,000 GeV or 1 TeV, and that's precisely the energy at which the Large Hadron Collider works. So the reason the Large Hadron Collider was built at the energy of the order of few TeV is to try to find the solution of the hierarchy problem, which necessarily requires something new, either new particles and new interactions, new dimensions, new ideas, to open up at the energy of the order of 1 TeV, and you certainly want to be a little bit above 1 TeV to be safe to be able to probe these things at the LHC. So at this point, let me move to the LHC itself, to the machine, and let's talk about several issues about the machine. Why do we build a machine which collides protons? Why do we build a machine which is a collider and not fixed target machine, and so forth? Well, the first question I would like to answer is how we create these large energies. We create these large energies in particle collisions. There are several ways of doing this. One is to accelerate the beam of protons and just slam them in the fixed material, target of your experiment. And this is how the field was developing for many years in the 60s and before, where most of the experiments were fixed target experiments. The problem with the fixed target experiment is that this square root of S for a particle which has incident energy E, which is much greater than particle mass, say if I accelerate protons to the energy much greater than their mass, and slam them in another proton, the total energy which I get out of these collisions is given by twice the root of energy times the mass of the proton, because most of the energy of the initial projectile actually goes in the overall boost of the system after the collision. On the other hand, if I collide two protons head on, each with the energy E, the total energy root S is equal to twice the energy of the proton. The system is at rest both before and after the collision, and therefore I could reuse the entire energy of two particles to create something new, for example, to create a pair of supersymmetric particles or the Higgs boson or any new physics. And you could immediately see that if you want to go to very high energy, essentially fixed target experiments run out of steam very quickly. If you take a 1 TeV tevatron beam of protons and use the fixed target, if you plug in 1000 GeV here, you get square root of 2000, only 45 GeV in the center of mass rain. On the other hand, if you collide protons and antiprotons head on with 1 TeV each, you get 50 times bigger energy, 45 times bigger energy, 2 TeV. And that's why what we are trying to do at the very high energies can only be achieved at the colliders. Now, because we are not using fixed target, because we have to essentially shoot one tiny beam of particles into another tiny beam of particles, the natural question which we need to ask is how many collisions we get per unit of time. And that obviously depends on how well you steer the beams, how well you could focus the two beams, and how many particles in these beams are you can achieve and you can accelerate per unit of time. So this feature of the collider is known as the luminosity, and the more luminous the machine is, the higher number of interactions you get, and that means that you could produce more new particles per second. We typically measure the luminosity of the machine, which is L, in the units which are 10 to some big number, centimeters minus 2, second minus 1. So let us think about these dimensions. If you have a process with the cross-section sigma, and the units of cross-sections in this case would be centimeters squared, if I multiply the luminosity of the machine by the cross-section of the process I am looking at, I get second minus 1, so I get hertz, or the rate of the process. So if I want to measure the cross-section with the cross-section, if I have a process with the cross-section of sigma and I want to have one interaction of that kind per second, my luminosity should compensate sigma. And now we could think about what kind of luminosities we need to achieve for this thing to work. Well, if you just look at the proton-proton interaction, sort of total cross-section of how much interactions we could get if two protons collide with each other, the cross-section of this process would be roughly equal to the cross-section of the proton, geometrical cross-section of the proton. Proton has a size of 1 Fermi, so the sigma pp is of the order of 10 to the minus 30 meters squared, which is 10 to the minus 26 centimeters squared. And the units which we use, because clearly we don't want to carry these large numbers in the exponent, we typically use unit of 1 bar, which is equal to 10 to the minus 24 centimeters squared. So you see that the proton-proton total cross-section, just from this simple geometrical argument, is of the order of 10 millibars. And well, the correct number is more like 100 millibars, but the approximation here works pretty well up to an order of magnitude. So that means that if you want to see one collision of proton with a proton per second, our luminosity has to be at least 10 to the 26 centimeters minus 2, second minus 1. However, most of the interactions of protons are completely not interesting to us. Those are grazing interactions where two protons are essentially elastically scattered from one to the other without any momentum transfer. So these interactions are known very well and really not even interesting to us for the last 40 years, and therefore we would like to look for the processes where, which are very rare, where really you interact not two, not two protons really interact at high energy, but two quarks, two constituents of protons, or two gluons inside the protons start interacting. And the typical cross-section for these interesting phenomena, such as production of supersymmetric particles or production of the Higgs boson, is anywhere from 1 femtobar, which is 10 to the minus 15 bar, to, say, 100 picobar, which is 10 to the minus 10 bar. So this is the range of cross-sections we are looking at in order to study this interesting phenomenon at the LHC, which means that 10 to the 26th machine won't be any interesting for us, because we would have to run for a year to get one event of that kind, and we would have to run for eternity to get one event of that kind. Therefore, we have to increase the luminosity of the machine. And the highest luminosity machine before the LHC was the Fermilab Teletron, which essentially ran at the luminosity 10 to the 32 centimeters minus 2 second minus 1. So it produced million instead of 1 pp interactions per second. Only small fractions of them very interesting. And the LHC is currently run at 10 times higher luminosity, 10 to the 33, and the ultimate goal is to go by another factor of 10 and reach the luminosity of roughly 10 to the 34 centimeters minus 2. If you think about how many interactions of that kind you can achieve, if you run the machine for 1 year, 1 year is pi 10 to the 7 seconds. However, the machine duty cycle never exceeds 30%. Really, 30%, only 30% of the operation of the machine can be used to produce collisions, because machine has shutdowns for several months a year. Machine has to refuel itself with protons before creating collisions. So the best machines, such as Tevatron, after many years of operation and things were understood very well, has a duty factor of about 30%, which means that 1 year is of the order of 10 to the 7 machine seconds. And if you look at the luminosity of 10 to the 33 centimeters minus 2 second minus 1, multiply them by the duration of 1 year, you would find out that the integrated luminosity, LDT, in 1 year is roughly 1 femtobar to the minus first power, which means that if you have a process with the cross-section of 1 femtobar, you produce 1 event per year. If you have a process with 100 picobar, you obviously produce 5 orders of magnitude more, 100,000 events per year. This is kind of typical cross-section which we produce W and Z bosons at the LHC, so we produce hundreds of thousands of these particles per year. This is a typical cross-section at which we would produce the most rare events, such as, say, additional gauge bosons, Z prime bosons, or W prime bosons, and the Higgs cross-section is somewhere in the middle, so the order of picobar, depending on the Higgs mass. So that's what we deal with. We first need to have a collider. Second, we need to have a very luminous collider. And this essentially defines the whole physics of the LHC and whole engineering of the LHC. So now let's talk about the LHC itself as the machine. And LHC was built in the existing tunnel, which was used for previous Epasimides collider at the border of France and Switzerland, in beautiful area close to Geneva. And essentially, LHC is a circle with the circumference of the order of 27 kilometers or 15 miles. So most of it is in France, some of it is in Switzerland. And the machine essentially has 4 experiments, which are installed in 4 points around the ring. And the 2 experiments on the Swiss and French side are ATLAS and CMS. CMS stands for compact muon solenoid. And the word compact is really probably a misnomer, because the CMS size is about a three-story building. It's only compact if you compare it with Atlas, which size is about a six-story building. But those are huge apparatus, and I'll tell you in a second how they operate. The other two experiments, which are smaller experiments, are LHCD, which is a special experiment which is designed to study the CP violation, which might be the reason for matter and antimatter symmetry in the universe. And the last big experiment is called ALICE, and this experiment actually has a special role, and it mainly operates when LHC collides not the protons but heavy ions, which is interesting for studies of the quantum chromodynamics at ultimate densities, very large densities. And I'm not going to talk about this part of the LHC problem. But Atlas and CMS are truly universal detectors, which are built to study all these problems I talked about, discover the Higgs, perhaps discover the supersymmetry if it exists at low masses, and so forth. So in order to achieve these enormous luminosities, unprecedented luminosities, and unprecedented energies, essentially we needed 10 times bigger machine than anything which has been built so far. And if you think about the parameters of this machine, I'll just give you a few numbers, they're really mind-boggling. So the machine operates currently at 7 TeV, ultimately it will go to 10 TeV. It accelerates approximately 1 nanomole of protons. It's almost something which people could now create in the lab. It's a measurable quantity of protons. So you really need about 10 to the 12 protons per bunch and 1,000 bunches to fill this machine. So you really use 10 to the 15 protons per one fill of the machine. So in many years of operations, we would destroy something like a mole of protons. That's a lot of protons to be destroyed. And obviously, we need so many protons to increase the luminosity of this machine. In order to run these protons at very high energy along this track, we need superconducting magnets. And these superconducting magnets run at very high current and obviously store a lot of energy. So just to give you an idea how much energy is stored just in the magnets of the superconducting magnets of this machine, this energy is about 10 gigajoule. 10 gigajoule is the energy, kinetic energy of fully loaded A380 aircraft at the cruising speed of 700 kilometers per hour, 500 miles per hour. So if something goes wrong with this energy, if it's essentially not dumped properly, you would have an explosion, because this energy could melt about 12 tons of copper. So that is one big problem of the machine. We have to protect it from quenches very, very carefully. We cannot afford the whole machine to quench, because that would be a disaster of the enormous proportion. Even if you look at the energy which is stored in the beams of the machine, it's also extremely high. Just so many protons accelerated to 7 TeV have an energy of the order of 350 megajoule. It's less than the energy stored in the magnets, but 350 megajoule is roughly equal to 200 pounds of TNT. So if you really were to dump the beam in one spot, it's equivalent of blowing this spot with 200 pounds of TNT. It's also equivalent to about 8 liters of gas, so think about how far your car could go, 8 liters of gas if it's Prius. And it's also equivalent, incidentally, to 15 kilo of chocolate. So don't try to eat 15 kilo of chocolate in one day. But that's how much energy we store in the beams. Now, the machine operates with superfluid helium so that we could cool this machine effectively, which is 1.9 Kelvin, that's below the lambda point, which makes this machine the coldest place in the solar system. Solar system sits at 3 Kelvin, as you know. It's also the emptiest place in the solar system, because the vacuum in the beam pipe is 10 to the minus 13 atmosphere, which is better than the vacuum at the very edges of the solar system, which we have explored with pioneers and the Vikings and other spacecraft. So the electricity consumption of the machine is roughly equal to the consumption of the whole county of Geneva, the whole city of Geneva and surrounding area, and it runs about 25 million Swiss francs per year just to operate the electricity. So it's really a mind-boggling enterprise. It's the triumph of engineering and cutting-edge electronics and cutting-edge accelerated technology. So in order to manage this machine, we built the detectors, which cost millions of Swiss francs, and they are very impressive detectors. These detectors essentially have similar design, which was tested in years of our understanding of how to run physics at proton accelerators, such as Tevatron and previous machines at lower energy. And the design of these detectors is essentially onion design or Russian doll design. So you have different shells of various detectors surrounding the interaction point. So this is my view of a proton going through the beam pipe. And the detector surrounds the this beam line. You put the detectors which have as little mass as possible, as close to the collision as possible, because you don't want to destroy particles before you need to. For example, you might want to measure the momentum of a charged particle, and a good way of doing this is to put this whole thing in a large magnetic field and put some ionization detector, kind of like a cloud chamber, of course, much faster version of cloud chamber, which would track this particle and see its momentum by the bending in the known magnetic field. If this particle is a photon, at some point, an electron, you want to measure its energy. And the way to measure the energy of the particle is to destroy this particle, to actually stop this particle in some absorber, and measure how much the temperature of the absorber changes. This is a calorimetric technique. So the device which we put inside is a tracking detector. Device which we put outside the tracking detector is electromagnetic calorimeter, ECAL. Where I destroy the photons, so photons would appear like blob of energies, and electrons would look like blob of energies with matching track pointing to them. I also want to study quarks, so I need to stop the quarks, and turns out that quarks take a little bit more material to be stopped. So ECAL is surrounded by HCAL, which stands for hadronic calorimeter, and this device stops the products of fragmentations of quarks and gluons, which we call particle jets. They look like stream of tracks, and then a blob of energy in both ECAL and HCAL, mainly in HCAL. So that allows us to measure electrons, photons, all the quarks, and the only thing which we need to add to this would be the muons. Muons are minimal ionizing particles, so they can easily go through the tons of material without stopping. So what we do is put another layer of tracking detectors outside the calorimeter, and we call them muon detectors. So anything which exits the calorimeter and perhaps gives you track in the inner detector, then almost nothing here and another track here, is a muon, and that allows us to measure muons. So the only thing which we do not measure now are the particles which interact weakly, just like muon, which don't have electromagnetic charge. And these are precisely the particles which would be excellent dark matter candidates. Dark matter cannot be charged for astrophysical reasons, and it's weakly interacting. So how do we detect the presence of dark matter in this detector where dark matter just escapes without any interactions with the detector? Well, we do it by using the fact that the detector built in such a way is extremely hermetic. Essentially, nothing escapes it if it interacts. So if we sum in the plane transverse to the beams all the momenta of different particles using the tracks in the tracking system, all the energy deposits in the calorimeter, and we see that the total momentum in the transverse plane is not equal to zero, that means that there was something escaping the detector. And this something escaping could be either a neutrino, which is a standard model example of particle, which is neutral and interacts weakly, or it could be a dark matter candidate. So Atlas and CMS detectors are both built with the same conceptual design. The data was in the detail. What do you use for various readout media? What do you use for various, what materials you use for various subdetectors in Atlas and CMS? And the last difference is how you create magnetic field and what value of magnetic field you create. In order to create large volume of high intensity magnetic field, you need superconducting solenoids. The cost of superconducting solenoid increases dramatically as you go to bigger and bigger radii, because even coating this solenoid together becomes a challenging engineering problem and it runs at very high current. So Atlas detector is more traditional. It has smaller solenoid, which encompasses their tracker detector. CMS design is more aggressive. It has the solenoid, which encompasses the calorimeter and the tracker all together. So it's a bigger solenoid, but this solenoid has twice the magnetic field of Atlas solenoid. CMS operates with magnetic field of 4 Tesla. And Atlas has magnetic field of 2 Tesla. However, the diameter of the tracker in Atlas is bigger than the diameter of tracker in CMS, so solenoids are in fact similar in size. So now I have this beautiful machine and the beautiful detector, and in the last 5 minutes, let me put it all together and give you a couple examples of what we are doing right now at the LHC, how we are trying to discover these particles. One thing which I mentioned to you is that in 1 year of operation, the machine should deliver about 1 inverse femtobar. And actually that just happened half a year in 2011. As of mid-June of 2011, the machine delivered the first inverse femtobar to the experiments. It runs at slightly higher luminosity than 10 to the 33, currently runs at 2 10 to the 33. That allows us to deliver this luminosity slightly faster than in 1 year. And this has to be compared with what we got last year when the machine was just coming up to the scheme. Last year, we only got 15 inverse picobar, which is 1/40 of the statistics we have now. And even with 15 inverse picobar, the LHC machine exceeded the sensitivity of the Tevatron in many searches for particles. We started to produce world best results because of the higher energy. If you go to the higher energy, the cross section for producing heavy objects increases dramatically, and even the small fraction of the luminosity of the Tevatron, which by now reached about 10 inverse femtobar, LHC could win. So clearly with 1 inverse femtobar, LHC start taking over the Tevatron in the entire scope of searches, from searches to the Higgs particles, to searches for supersymmetric particles, extra dimensions, and other models of new physics beyond the standard model. And not only we were able to get this luminosity, but within 1 month of accelerated delivering this luminosity, we showed the results based on the luminosity. So the time we need to process this data is extremely short. We, in fact, could produce results a week after accelerated delivers a certain set of data, and another couple of weeks just needed for us to go through the approval of these results so that calibration has chance to review the results, ask questions and comments, and so forth. But the turnaround time is extremely fast, and that's essentially instant gratification, and that's very nice. So the results which we showed based on 1 inverse femtobar data set were first shown at the EPS conference, European Physics Society conference, in Grenoble this year. And two results which I would like to highlight are searches for supersymmetry and searches for the Higgs boson. For the supersymmetry, the reason we have the dark matter candidate in supersymmetry is that typically one additional thing which we add to the supersymmetric picture is the so-called R parity, which is a special parity, somewhat artificial, but essentially you say that all the standard model particles have R parity equals to +1, all the super partners have R parity equals to -1, and R parity is conserved. If you impose R parity conservation, the immediate consequence is that you cannot produce just single supersymmetric particle. You have to produce them in a pair, particle and antiparticle. Antiparticle will have opposite R. So that means that you always produce supersymmetric particles in pairs because your initial state has particle and antiparticle, so R parity is equal to zero, so your final state must have R parity equals to zero. And the R parity for standard model particles is zero, and R parity for particles, for supersymmetric particles, is either plus one or minus one, depending on the particle, antiparticle. Sorry for this confusion. So if you produce particles in pairs, the ones which are produced most copiously at the LHC would be particles which interact strongly, which are super partners of quarks and gluons. For example, you could produce a pair of gluinos, and these gluinos decay via some cascade, they're emitting other standard model particles, but the end point of this decay has to be the particle which is supersymmetric particle, which has the same R parity as gluino. But this particle, if it's the lightest supersymmetric particles, it has no other particles to decay in. So that means that this particle has to be stable. And in many models with supersymmetry, this stable particle is the so-called neutralino, I0, which is the supersymmetric partner of photon and Z, mixture of photon and Z. And this particle, neutralino, is an excellent candidate for the dark matter because it has all the right properties. It has weak interaction, it has the mass of the order of 100 GeV, which creates proper abundances for these dark matter particles. So it's one of the most favorite dark matter candidates from the point of view of particle physics. So we've produced a pair of gluinos which cascade decay in a neutralino plus something else. Each of them does this. So at the end, you have two neutralinos and a bunch of quarks or leptons. So what you're looking at in the collider detector is the process which has jets plus leptons plus this missing transverse momentum, which historically we actually call missing transverse energy, something which gives us momentum imbalance. And if you think about this, this is extremely challenging experimental signature, because if your detector has a hole in it, if some of the channels are dead and not registering the particles, it's very easy to create instrumental, artificial missing ET simply because you missed something and not because you took into account all the particles in the event. So a lot of work went into understanding of the detector and proving with standard model processes with neutrinos that we understand detector to the level of about 10 to the minus 5, 10 to the minus 6, where we are sure that if we see missing transverse energy of certain magnitude, this missing transverse energy is real and not instrumental fake. And for the Tevatron calibrations, these searches took about 3 years, because it took about 3 years for the experiments to understand them, the performance of the detector to the level where we could trust missing ET. For the LHC, this took only 3 months. Our first results based on JETS plus MET search were shown last December, and already then they exceeded the Tevatron. What we showed with one inverse femtobarn is actually rather bad news for SUSY, because we haven't seen supersymmetric particles through the masses of gluinos and quarks, the superpartner of quarks, of the order of 1.2 TeV. We know that the mass of the gluino and quark should be more than 1.2 TeV, which already brings us back to the realm of hierarchy problem, because we are getting to 1% fine tuning. However, this is not really a very complete picture, because we only look for the simplest way of producing these supersymmetric particles. There are other supersymmetric particles which actually might be lighter than gluinos, and typical example is superpartner of top quark, which decay more complex. So this simple search for jets plus missing ET won't be necessarily sensitive for these particles. And from the Tevatron, we know that the mass limit on this particle is fairly small. It's only about 200 GeV. We don't know if these particles actually exist beyond 200 GeV, because the Tevatron has run out of steam with their energy. And for the LHC, it's the next natural step. We first looked under the lamp pole for obvious signs of supersymmetry. Unfortunately, we haven't found any, but it doesn't mean that we looked through the entire phase space. We only looked in the place where it had most of light from there. from the lamppost, and now we're walking to a different direction, trying to explore other areas of the supersymmetry parameter space where the lighter species might still be present. But the bottom line is that the machine came up so quick that I think a year from now we will definitely know a lot about the low energy supersymmetry, if it exists or not. Some of the corners of the parameter space may need the full machine energy of 14 TeV, for which we'll need to wait another year, but for most of the region of the parameter space, we should be able to essentially find or rule out low energy supersymmetry within the next year or so. The other very interesting process is the search for the Higgs particle, and Higgs particle decays in the heaviest particle in the standard model, for example, in WW or ZZ. This is a very clean process to look for. We know exactly how to look for this. However, you're only sensitive to the Higgs masses above the production threshold of this pair of particles, which is 160 GeV for WW and 180 GeV for ZZ. Lighter Higgs is actually a very challenging beast to find, because if we cannot produce the WW and ZZ, we have to go to the next lightest particle, which is a big work, or tau particle, and you have to look for Higgs decay in a pair of big quarks or pair of taus. Now, this is a very challenging process experimentally, because as any strong particles, big quarks produce copious Levi QCD interactions, and that makes it very hard to look for the Higgs. However, for low mass Higgs, we have another channel which is very interesting. It's a photon-photon channel, and you would say that Higgs cannot be recoupled to photons because photons are massless and Higgs couples to mass. But in fact, Higgs couples to the photons via the loop diagrams, via triangle diagram, where it would say top quark. Higgs likes to couple to top quarks, and top quarks couple to photons because they have electric charge. You would also put W's instead of top quarks in this diagram. So by this triangular diagram, Higgs in fact could decay in pair of photons, and this is a very good channel to look for the Higgs if its mass is close to the current limits from the previous accelerators, which is LEP accelerator, which has the mass of the Higgs curve somewhere between 114 GeV and 180 GeV or so, if you trust the indirect ways of looking for the Higgs via the radiative corrections and loop diagrams, a la the loop diagrams I talked about when I talked about the hierarchy problem. So with this new set of data, both Atlas and CMS showed the results for the Higgs searches, which extend the Tevatron sensitivity enormously. So far, Tevatron was only able to rule out a small region of parameter space right around the mass of the Higgs of 160 GeV, where WW channel opens up and sensitivity increases. The LHC experiment is the first inverse femtobar. We're able to exclude large range of masses of a heavy Higgs. Essentially, Higgs between 200 and 350 GeV has been excluded, which is good because we actually expect Higgs to be much lighter. But what's even more interesting, that both calibrations see slight excess in the WW channel, where 1W could be a virtual particle. So you don't see it as a mass on the mass shell. So you could go a little lower than 160 GeV. And it turns out that this excess for both calibrations is around 140 or so, 140, 150 GeV. Whether this is a real excess or we simply don't understand quite well the standard model WW production remains to be seen. This is a brand new result, but it may very well be the first hint for the Higgs right in the range where the standard model wants it to be, and definitely with the extra luminosity we're going to get as early as this year, we should be able to definitively answer the question if 140 GeV Higgs exists. It will take a little bit longer to explore the entire range between 114 GeV all the way to the highest masses to which LHC is sensitive. But the quest is on, and the results are very, very promising, and we might be sitting right at the edge of the discovery of this elusive particle, which we're trying to find for 35 years now, unfortunately, unsuccessfully so far. So that brings me to the end of my talk. I just want to tell you about other things which are going ongoing at the LHC. We not only search for the Higgs and supersymmetry, we actually look for the whole host of deviations from the standard model, either looking for particular models of new physics proposed by theorists in the last couple of decades, or even just doing completely model independent searches by looking at the final state where we know standard model predictions very well and try to look for any deviations from the standard model which may be which would probably be evidence for new physics. We look for things which connect leptons and quarks. Lepton quarks are one example of these things. We look for additional bosons. We look a lot at the top quark and tau channels because those are the ones which might be telling us a little bit more about Higgs than lighter generation of quarks. And we look for additional generation of quarks. After all, we don't know if there's only three generations of matter. Maybe there's a fourth generation. There's a lot of searches in this direction. We are looking for more speculative things such as extra dimensions, black holes, vanishing dimensions, and so forth. And the plans are that by the end of this year, 2011, we would have roughly five times the statistics we analyzed so far. We expect five inverse femtobar on faith. And most exciting things is going to happen next year, where we expect of the order of 20 inverse femtobar, factor of 10 more than we have so far. And most importantly, now the machine got enough confidence to actually consider going back to higher energy. And we may be running anywhere between 8 and 10 GeV next year. This will be decided at the end of this year when they do some measurements on the junctions between the magnets to make sure that this operation is safe. And even if you go from 7 to 8 GeV, that is equivalent to a factor of 2 higher effective luminosity for many searches. So 20 inverse femtobar at 8 GeV is like 40 inverse femtobar at 7 GeV for most of this scenario I described, and 10 GeV obviously will be better. And then in 2013, the machine would take little vacation for about 18 months to retrofit all these interconnects between the magnets, which is necessary to go to the design energy of the 14 GeV, and the machine would be starting 2014 delivering about 100 inverse femtobar per year at close to 14 GeV. But the hope for that for the next 2 years, 2012 and 2013, while we still will be analyzing data of 2012 while the machine is going to be retrofitted, that we should be able to answer at least some of these problems, either the problem of the cosmic pi, definitely the problem of the Higgs, that the Higgs exists as a fundamental particles, and perhaps we will find something completely unexpected because we are looking at many, many different places and no stone remains unturned. Thank you very much.